Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs. The Drunkard's Walk: How Randomness Rules Our Lives, by Leonard Mlodinow, narrated by Lloyd James. Prologue. A few years ago, a man won the Spanish National Lottery with a ticket that ended in the number 48. Proud of his accomplishment, he revealed the theory that brought him the riches. "I dreamed of the number 7 for 7 straight nights," he said, "and 7 times 7 is 48. Those of us with a better command of our multiplication tables might chuckle at the man's error, but we all create our own view of the world and then employ it to filter and process our perceptions, extracting meaning from the ocean of data that washes over us in daily life. And we often make errors that, though less obvious, are just as significant as his. The fact that human intuition is ill-suited to situations involving uncertainty was known as early as the 1930s, when researchers noted that people could neither make up a sequence of numbers that passed mathematical tests for randomness, nor recognize reliably whether a given string was randomly generated. In the past few decades, a new academic field has emerged to study how people make judgments and decisions when faced with imperfect or incomplete information. Their research has shown that when chance is involved, people's thought processes are often seriously flawed. The work draws from many disciplines, from mathematics and the traditional sciences, as well as cognitive psychology, behavioral economics, and modern neuroscience. But although such studies were legitimated by a recent Nobel Prize in economics, their lessons, for the most part, have not trickled down from academic circles to the popular psyche. This book is an attempt to remedy that. It is about the principles that govern chance, the development of those ideas, and the manner in which they play out in politics, business, medicine, economics, sports, leisure, and other areas of human affairs. It's also about the way we make choices and the processes that lead us to make mistaken judgments and poor decisions when confronted with randomness or uncertainty. Information that is lacking often invites competing interpretations. That's why such great effort was required to confirm global warming, why drugs are sometimes declared safe and then pulled from the market, and presumably why not everyone agrees with my observation that chocolate milkshakes are an indispensable component of a heart-healthy diet. Unfortunately, the misinterpretation of data has many negative consequences, both large and small. As we'll see, for example, both doctors and patients often misinterpret statistics regarding the effectiveness of drugs and the meaning of important medical tests. Parents, teachers, and students misunderstand the significance of exams such as the SAT, and wine connoisseurs make the same mistakes about wine ratings. Investors draw invalid conclusions from the historical performance of mutual funds. In sports, we have developed a culture in which, based on intuitive feelings of correlation, a team's success or failure is often attributed largely to the ability of the coach. As a result, when teams fail, the coach is often fired. Mathematical analysis of firings in all major sports, however, has shown that those firings had, on average, no effect on team performance. An analogous phenomenon occurs in the corporate world, where CEOs are thought to have superhuman power to make or break a company. Yet time and time again, at Kodak, Lucent, Xerox, and other companies, that power has proved illusory. In the 1990s, for instance, when he ran GE Capital Services under Jack Welch, Gary Wendt was thought of as one of the smartest businessmen in the country. Wendt parlayed that reputation into a $45 million bonus when he was hired to run the troubled finance company Conseco. Investors apparently agreed that with Wendt at the helm, Conseco's troubles were over. The company's stock tripled within a year. But 2 years after that, Wendt abruptly resigned. Conseco went bankrupt, and the stock was trading for pennies. Had Wendt's task been impossible? Was he asleep at the wheel? Or had his coronation rested on questionable assumptions? For example, that an executive has a near-absolute ability to affect a company, or a person's single past success is a reliable indicator of future performance. On any specific occasion, one cannot be confident of the answers without examining the details of the situation at hand. I will do that in several instances in this book, but more important, I will present the tools needed to identify the footprints of chance. To swim against the current of human intuition is a difficult task. As we'll see, the human mind is built to identify for each event a definite cause, and can, therefore, have a hard time accepting the influence of unrelated or random factors. And so the first step is to realize that success or failure sometimes arises neither from great skill nor from great incompetence, but from, as the economist Armin Alkian wrote, fortuitous circumstances. Random processes are fundamental in nature and are ubiquitous in our everyday lives, yet most people do not understand them or think much about them. The title, The Drunkard's Walk, comes from a mathematical term describing random motion, such as the paths molecules follow as they fly through space, incessantly bumping and being bumped by their sister molecules. That can be a metaphor for our lives, our paths from college to career, from single life to family life, from first hole of golf to 18th. The surprise is that the tools used to understand the drunkard's walk can also be employed to help understand the events of everyday life. The goal of this book is to illustrate the role of chance in the world around us and to show how we may recognize it at work in human affairs. I hope that after this tour of the world of randomness, you, the reader, will begin to see life in a different light, with a deeper understanding of the everyday world. Chapter 1. Peering Through the Eyepiece of Randomness. I remember as a teenager watching the yellow flame of the Sabbath candles dancing randomly above the white paraffin cylinders that fueled them. I was too young to think candlelight romantic, but I still found it magical, because of the flickering images created by the fire. They shifted and morphed, grew and waned, all without apparent cause or plan. Surely, I believed, there must be rhyme and reason underlying the flame, some pattern that scientists could predict and explain with their mathematical equations. "Life isn't like that," my father told me. "Sometimes things happen that cannot be foreseen." He told me of the time when, in Buchenwald, the Nazi concentration camp in which he was imprisoned and starving, he stole a loaf of bread from the bakery. The baker had the Gestapo gather everyone who might have committed the crime and line the suspects up. "Who stole the bread?" the baker asked. When no one answered, he told the guards to shoot the suspects one by one until either they were all dead or someone confessed. My father stepped forward to spare the others. He did not try to paint himself in a heroic light, but told me that he did it because he expected to be shot either way. Instead of having him killed, though, the baker gave my father a plum job as his assistant. "A chance event," my father said. "It had nothing to do with you, but had it happened differently, you would never have been born." It struck me then that I have Hitler to thank for my existence, for the Germans had killed my father's wife and two young children, erasing his prior life. And so were it not for the war, my father would never have emigrated to New York, never have met my mother, also a refugee, and never have produced me and my two brothers. My father rarely spoke of the war. I didn't realize it then, but years later it dawned on me that whenever he shared his ordeals, It was not so much because he wanted me to know of his experiences, but rather because he wanted to impart a larger lesson about life. War is an extreme circumstance, but the role of chance in our lives is not predicated on extremes. The outline of our lives, like the candle's flame, is continuously coaxed in new directions by a variety of random events that, along with our responses to them, determine our fate. As a result, life is both hard to predict and hard to interpret. Just as, looking at a Rorschach blot, you might see Madonna and I, a duck-billed platypus, the data we encounter in business, law, medicine, sports, the media, or your child's third-grade report card can be read in many ways. Yet interpreting the role of chance in an event is not like interpreting a Rorschach blot. There are right ways and wrong ways to do it. We often employ intuitive processes when we make assessments and choices in uncertain situations. Those processes, no doubt, carried an evolutionary advantage when we had to decide whether a saber-toothed tiger was smiling because it was fat and happy, or because it was famished and saw us as its next meal. But the modern world has a different balance, and today those intuitive processes come with drawbacks. When we use our habitual ways of thinking to deal with today's tigers, we can be led to decisions that are less than optimal or even incongruous. That conclusion comes as no surprise to those who study how the brain processes uncertainty. Many studies point to a close connection between the parts of our brain that make assessments of chance situations and those that handle the human characteristic that is often considered our prime source of irrationality, our emotions. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, for example, shows that risk and reward are assessed by parts of the dopaminergic system, a brain reward circuit important for motivational and emotional processes. The images show, too, that the amygdala, which is also linked to our emotional state, especially fear, is activated when we make decisions couched in uncertainty. The mechanisms by which people analyze situations involving chance are an intricate product of evolutionary factors, brain structure, personal experience, knowledge, and emotion. In fact, the human response to uncertainty is so complex that sometimes different structures within the brain come to different conclusions and apparently fight it out to determine which one will dominate. For example, if your face swells to 5 times its normal size, 3 out of every 4 times you eat shrimp, the logical left hemisphere of your brain will attempt to find a pattern. The intuitive right hemisphere of your brain, on the other hand, will simply say, avoid shrimp. At least that's what researchers found in less painful experimental setups. The game is called probability guessing. In lieu of toying with shrimp and histamine, subjects are shown a series of cards or lights, which can have 2 colors, say, green and red. Things are arranged so that the colors will appear with different probabilities, but otherwise without a pattern. For example, red might appear twice as often as green in a sequence like red, red, green, red, green, red, red, green, green, red, 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 and so on. The task of the subject, after watching for a while, is to predict whether each new member of the sequence will be red or green. The game has 2 basic strategies. One is to always guess the color that you notice occurs most frequently. That is the route favored by rats and other non-human animals. If you employ this strategy, you are guaranteed a certain degree of success, but you are also conceding that you will do no better. For instance, if green shows up 75% of the time, and you decide to always guess green, you will be correct 75% of the time. The other strategy is to match your proportion of green and red guesses to the proportion of green and red you observed in the past. If the greens and reds appear in a pattern, you can figure out the pattern. This strategy enables you to guess right every time. But if the colors appear at random, you would be better off sticking with the first strategy. In the case where green randomly appears 75% of the time, the second strategy will lead to the correct guess only about 6 times in 10. Humans usually try to guess the pattern, and in the process, we allow ourselves to be outperformed by a rat. But there are people with certain types of post-surgical brain impairment, called a split brain, that precludes the right and left hemispheres of the brain from communicating with each other. If the probability experiment is performed on these patients, such that they see the colored light or card with only their left eye and employ only their left hand to signal their predictions, it amounts to an experiment on the right side of the brain. But if the experiment is performed so as to involve only their right eye and right hand, it is an experiment on the left brain. When researchers performed these experiments, they found that, in some patients, the right hemisphere always chose to guess the more frequent color, and the left hemisphere always tried to guess the pattern. Making wise assessments and choices in the face of uncertainty is a rare skill. But like any skill, it can be improved with experience. In the pages that follow, I will examine the role of chance in the world around us, the ideas that have been developed over the centuries to help us understand that role, and the factors that often lead us astray. The British philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell wrote, "We all start from native realism, that is, the doctrine that things are what they seem. We think that grass is green, that stones are hard, and that snow is cold. But physics assures us that the greenness of grass, the hardness of stones, and the coldness of snow are not the greenness of grass, the hardness of stones, and the coldness of snow that we know in our own experience, but something very different." In what follows, we will peer at life through the eyepiece of randomness and see that many of the events of our lives, too, are not quite what they seem, but rather something very different. In 2002, the Nobel Committee awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics to a scientist named Daniel Kahneman. Economists do all sorts of things these days. They explain why teachers are paid so little, why football teams are worth so much, and why bodily functions help set a limit on the size of hog farms. A hog excretes 3 to 5 times as much as a human, so a farm with thousands of hogs on it often produces more waste than the neighboring cities. Despite all the great research generated by economists, the 2002 Nobel Prize was notable because Kahneman is not an economist. He is a psychologist, and for decades, with the late Amos Tversky, Kahneman studied and clarified the kinds of misperceptions of randomness that fuel many of the common fallacies I will talk about in this book. The greatest challenge in understanding the role of randomness in life is that although the basic principles of randomness arrive from everyday logic, many of the consequences that follow from those principles prove counterintuitive. Kahneman and Tversky's studies were themselves spurred by a random event. In the mid-1960s, Kahneman, then a junior psychology professor at Hebrew University, agreed to perform a rather unexciting chore, lecturing to a group of Israeli Air Force flight instructors on the conventional wisdom of behavior modification and its application to the psychology of flight training. Kahneman drove home the point that rewarding positive behavior works, but punishing mistakes does not. One of his students interrupted, voicing an opinion that would lead Kahneman to an epiphany and guide his research for decades. "I have often praised people warmly for beautifully executed maneuvers, and the next time they always do worse," the flight instructor said. "And I've screamed at people for badly executing maneuvers, and by and large the next time they improve. Don't tell me that rewards work and punishment doesn't work. My experience contradicts it." The other flight instructors agreed. To Kahneman, the flight instructor's experiences rang true. On the other hand, Kahneman believed in the animal experiments that demonstrated that reward works better than punishment. He ruminated on this apparent paradox, and then it struck him. The screaming preceded the improvement, but contrary to appearances, it did not cause it. How can that be? The answer lies in a phenomenon called regression toward the mean. That is, in any series of random events, an extraordinary event is most likely to be followed, due purely to chance, by a more ordinary one. Here's how it works. The student pilots all had a certain personal ability to fly fighter planes. Raising their skill level involved many factors and required extensive practice. So, although their skill was slowly improving through flight training, the change wouldn't be noticeable from one maneuver to the next. Any especially good or especially poor performance was thus mostly a matter of luck. So if a pilot made an exceptionally good landing, one far above his normal level of performance, then the odds would be good that he would perform closer to his norm, that is, worse, the next day. And if his instructor had praised him, it would appear that the praise had done no good. But if a pilot made an exceptionally bad landing, running the plane off the end of the runway and into the vat of corn chowder at the base cafeteria, then the odds would be good that the next day he would perform closer to his norm, that is, better. And if his instructor had a habit of screaming, "You clumsy ape!" when a student performed poorly, it would appear that his criticism did some good. In this way, an apparent pattern would emerge. Student performs well, praise does no good. Student performs poorly, instructor compares student to lower primate at high volume, student improves. The instructors in Kahneman's class had concluded from such experiences that their screaming was a powerful educational tool. In reality, it made no difference at all. This error in intuition spurred Kahneman's thinking. He wondered, are such misconceptions universal? Do we, like the flight instructors, believe that harsh criticism improves our children's behavior or our employees' performance? Do we make other misjudgments when faced with uncertainty? Kahneman knew that human beings, by necessity, employ certain strategies to reduce the complexity of tasks of judgment, and that intuition about probabilities plays an important part in that process. Will you feel sick after eating that luscious-looking ceviche tostada from the street vendor? You don't consciously recall all the comparable food stands you've patronized, count the number of times you've spent the following night guzzling Pepto-Bismol, and come up with a numerical estimate. You let your intuition do the work. But research in the 1950s and early 60s indicated that people's intuition about randomness fails them in such situations. How widespread, Kahneman wondered, was this misunderstanding of uncertainty? And what are its implications for human decision-making? A few years passed, and Kahneman invited a fellow junior professor, Amos Tversky, to give a guest lecture at one of his seminars. Later, at lunch, Kahneman mentioned his developing ideas to Tversky. Over the next 30 years, Tversky and Kahneman found that even among sophisticated subjects, when it came to random processes, whether in military or sports situations, business quandaries or medical questions, people's beliefs and intuition very often let them down. Suppose four publishers have rejected the manuscript for your thriller about love, war, and global warming. Your intuition and the bad feeling in the pit of your stomach might say that the rejections by all those publishing experts mean your manuscript is no good. But is your intuition correct? Is your novel unsellable? We all know from experience that if several tosses of a coin come up heads, it doesn't mean we are tossing a two-headed coin. Could it be that publishing success is so unpredictable that even if our novel was destined for the bestseller list, numerous publishers could miss the point and send those letters that say thanks but no thanks? One book in the 1950s was rejected by publishers, who responded with such comments as very dull, a dreary record of typical family bickering, petty annoyances, and adolescent emotions, and even if the work had come to light 5 years ago, when the subject, World War II, was timely, I don't see that there would have been a chance for it. That book, The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank, has sold 30 million copies, making it one of the best-selling books in history. Rejection letters were also sent to Sylvia Plath because there certainly isn't enough genuine talent for us to take notice. To George Orwell for Animal Farm because it is impossible to sell animal stories in the U.S. And to Isaac Bashevis Singer because it's Poland and the rich Jews again. Before he hit it big, Tony Hillerman's agent dumped him, advising him that he should get rid of all that Indian stuff. Those were not isolated misjudgments. In fact, many books destined for great success had to survive not just rejection, but repeated rejection. For example, few books today are considered to have more obvious and nearly universal appeal than the works of John Grisham, Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, and J.K. Rowling. Yet the manuscripts they wrote before they became famous, all eventually hugely successful, were all repeatedly rejected. John Grisham's manuscript for A Time to Kill was rejected by 26 publishers. His second manuscript, for The Firm, drew interest from publishers only after a bootleg copy circulating in Hollywood drew a $600,000 offer for the movie rights. And Dr. Seuss's first children's book, And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, was rejected by 27 publishers. And J.K. Rowling's first Harry Potter manuscript was rejected by 9. Then there is the other side of the coin, the side anyone in the business knows all too well. The many authors who had great potential but never made it. John Grisham's who quit after the first 20 rejections, or J.K. Rowling's who gave up after the first 5. After his many rejections, one such writer, John Kennedy Toole, lost hope of ever getting his novel published and committed suicide. His mother persevered, however, and 11 years later, A Confederacy of Dunces was published. It won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction and has sold nearly 2 million copies. There exists a vast gulf of randomness and uncertainty between the creation of a great novel, or piece of jewelry, or chocolate chip cookie, and the presence of huge stacks of that novel, or jewelry, or bags of cookies, at the front of thousands of retail outlets. That's why successful people in every field are almost universally members of a set, the set of people who don't give up. A lot of what happens to us, success in our careers, in our investments, in our life decisions, both major and minor, is as much the result of random factors as the result of skill, preparedness, and hard work. So the reality that we perceive is not a direct reflection of the people or circumstances that underlie it, but is instead an image blurred by the randomizing effects of unforeseeable or fluctuating external forces. That is not to say that ability doesn't matter. It is one of the factors that increase the chances of success. But the connection between actions and results is not as direct as we might like to believe. Thus, our past is not so easy to understand, nor is our future so easy to predict. And in both enterprises, we benefit from looking beyond the superficial explanations. We habitually underestimate the effects of randomness. Our stockbroker recommends that we invest in the Latin American mutual fund that beat the pants off the domestic funds 5 years running. Our doctor attributes that increase in our triglycerides to our new habit of enjoying a Hostess ding-dong with milk every morning after dutifully feeding the kids a breakfast of mangoes and non-fat yogurt. We may or may not take our stockbroker's or doctor's advice, but few of us question whether he or she has enough data to give it. In the political world, the economic world, the business world, even when careers and millions of dollars are at stake. Chance events are often conspicuously misinterpreted as accomplishments or failures. Hollywood provides a nice illustration. Are the rewards and punishments of the Hollywood game deserved? Or does luck play a far more important role in box office success and failure than people imagine? We all understand that genius doesn't guarantee success, but it's seductive to assume that success must come from genius. Yet the idea that no one can know in advance whether a film will hit or miss has been an uncomfortable suspicion in Hollywood, at least since the novelist and screenwriter William Goldman enunciated it in his classic 1983 book, Adventures in the Screen Trade. In that book, Goldman quoted the former studio executive David Picker as saying, "If I had said yes to all the projects I turned down and no to all the other ones I took, it would have worked out about the same." That's not to say that a jittery homemade horror video could become a hit just as easily as, say, Exorcist: The Beginning, which cost an estimated $80 million. Well, actually, that is what happened some years back with the Blair Witch Project. It cost the filmmakers a mere $60,000, but brought in $140 million in domestic box office revenue, more than three times the business of Exorcist. Still, that's not what Goldwyn was saying. He was referring only to professionally made Hollywood films with production values good enough to land the film a respectable distributor. And Goldman didn't deny that there are reasons for a film's box office performance. But he did say that those reasons are so complex and the path from green light to opening weekend so vulnerable to unforeseeable and uncontrollable influences that educated guesses about an unmade film's potential aren't much better than flips of a coin. Examples of Hollywood's unpredictability are easy to find. Movie buffs will remember the great expectations the studios had for the mega-flops Ishtar, Warren Beatty plus Dustin Hoffman plus a $55 million budget equals $14 million in box office revenue, and Last Action Hero, Arnold Schwarzenegger plus $85 million equals $50 million. On the other hand, you might recall the grave doubts that executives at Universal Studios had about the young director George Lucas's film, American Graffiti, shot for less than $1 million. Despite their skepticism, it took in $115 million. But still, that didn't stop them from having even graver doubts about Lucas's next idea. He called the story Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Whills. Universal called it unproducible. Ultimately, 20th Century Fox made the film, but the studio's faith in the project went only so far. It paid Lucas just $200,000 to write and direct it. In exchange, Lucas received the sequel and merchandising rights. In the end, Star Wars took in $461 million on a budget of $13 million, and Lucas had himself an empire. Given the fact that greenlight decisions are made years before a film is completed, and films are subject to many unpredictable factors that arise during those years of production and marketing, not to mention the inscrutable tastes of the audience, Goldman's theory doesn't seem at all far-fetched. It is also one that is supported by much recent economic research. Despite all this, studio executives are not judged by the bread-and-butter management skills that are as essential to the head of the United States Steel Corporation as they are to the head of Paramount Pictures. Instead, they are judged by their ability to pick hits. If Goldman is right, that ability is mere illusion. And in spite of his or her swagger, no executive is worth that $25 million contract. Deciding just how much of an outcome is due to skill and how much to luck is not a no-brainer. Random events often come like the raisins in a box of cereal, in groups, streaks, and clusters. And although fortune is fair in potentialities, she is not fair in outcomes. That means that if each of 10 Hollywood executives tosses 10 coins, although each has an equal chance of being the winner or the loser, in the end there will be winners and losers. In this example, the chances are 2 out of 3 that at least one of the executives will score 8 or more heads or tails. Imagine that George Lucas makes a new Star Wars film and in one test market decides to perform a crazy experiment. He releases the identical film under 2 titles, Star Wars Episode A and Star Wars Episode B. Each film has its own marketing campaign and distribution schedule, with the corresponding details identical except that the trailers and ads for one film say Episode A and those for the other, Episode B. Now we make a contest out of it. Which film will be more popular? Say we look at the first 20,000 moviegoers and record the film they choose to see, ignoring those diehard fans who will go to both and then insist there were subtle but meaningful differences between the two. Since the films and their marketing campaigns are identical, we can mathematically model the game this way. Imagine lining up all the viewers in a row and flipping a coin for each viewer in turn. If the coin lands heads up, he or she sees Episode A. If the coin lands tails up, it's Episode B. Because the coin has an equal chance of coming up either way, you might think that in this experimental box office war, each film should be in the lead about half the time. But the mathematics of randomness say otherwise. The most probable number of chances in the lead is 0, and it is 88 times more probable that one of the two films will lead through all 20,000 customers than it is that, say, the lead continuously seesaws. The lesson is not that there is no difference between films, but that some films will do better than others, even if all the films are identical. Such issues are not discussed in corporate boardrooms, in Hollywood or elsewhere, and so the typical patterns of randomness, apparent hot or cold streaks, or the bunching of data into clusters, are routinely misinterpreted, and worse, acted on, as if they represented a new trend. One of the most high-profile examples of anointment and regicide in modern Hollywood was the case of Sherry Lansing, who ran Paramount with great success for many years. Under Lansing, Paramount won Best Picture awards for Forrest Gump, Braveheart, and Titanic, and posted its 2 highest-grossing years ever. Then, Lansing's reputation suddenly plunged, and she was dumped after Paramount experienced, as Variety put it, a long stretch of underperformance at the box office. In mathematical terms, there is both a short and long explanation for Lansing's fate. First, the short answer. Listen to this series of percentages. 11.4, 10.6, 11.3, 7.4, 7.1, 6.7. Notice something? Lansing's boss, Sumner Redstone, did too. And for him, the trend was significant, for those 6 numbers represented the market share of Paramount's motion picture group for the final 6 years of Lansing's tenure. The trend caused Business Week to speculate that Lansing may simply no longer have Hollywood's hot hand. Soon, Lansing announced she was leaving, and a few months later, a talent manager named Brad Gray was brought on board. How can a surefire genius lead a company through 7 great years and then fail practically overnight? There were plenty of theories explaining Lansing's early success. While Paramount was doing well, Lansing was praised for making it one of Hollywood's best-run studios, and for her knack for turning conventional stories into $100 million hits. When her fortune changed, the revisionists took over. Her penchant for making successful remakes and sequels became a drawback. Most damning of all, perhaps, was the notion that her failure was due to her middle-of-the-road tastes. She was now blamed for greenlighting such box office dogs as Timeline and Lara Croft Tomb Raider: The Cradle of Life. Suddenly, the conventional wisdom was that Lansing was risk-averse, old-fashioned, and out of touch with the trends. But can she really be blamed for thinking that a Michael Crichton bestseller would be promising movie fodder? And where were all the Lara Croft critics when the first Tomb Raider film took in $131 million in box office revenue? Even if the theories of Lansing's shortcomings were plausible, consider how abruptly her demise occurred. Did she become risk-averse and out of touch overnight because Paramount's market share plunged that suddenly? One year, Lansing was flying high. The next, she was a punchline for late-night comedians. Her change of fortune might have been understandable if, like others in Hollywood, she had become depressed over a nasty divorce proceeding, had been charged with embezzlement, or had joined a religious cult. That was not the case. And she certainly hadn't sustained any damage to her cerebral cortex. The only evidence of Lansing's newly developed failings that her critics could offer was, in fact, her newly developed failings. In hindsight, it is clear that Lansing was fired because of the industry's misunderstanding of randomness, and not because of her flawed decision-making. Paramount's films for the following year were already in the pipeline when Lansing left the company. So, if we want to know roughly how Lansing would have done in some parallel universe in which she remained in her job, all we need to do is look at the data in the year following her departure. With such films as War of the Worlds and The Longest Yard, Paramount had its best summer in a decade and saw its market share rebound to nearly 10%. This isn't merely ironic. It's again that aspect of randomness called regression toward the mean. A Variety headline on the subject read, "Parting Gifts, Old Regimes, Picks, Fuel, Paramount, Rebound." But one can't help but think that had Viacom, Paramount's parent company, had more patience, the headline might have read, "Banner Year Puts Paramount and Lansing's Career Back on Track." Sherry Lansing had good luck at the beginning and bad luck at the end, but it could have been worse. She could have had her bad luck at the beginning. That's what happened to a Columbia Pictures chief named Mark Canton. Described as box office savvy and enthusiastic shortly after he was hired, he was fired after his first few years produced disappointing box office results. Criticized by one unnamed colleague for being incapable of distinguishing the winners from the losers, and by another for being too busy cheerleading, this disgraced man left in the pipeline when he departed such films as Men in Black, $589 million in worldwide box office revenue, Air Force One, $315 million, The Fifth Element, $264 million, Jerry Maguire, $274 million, and Anaconda, $137 million. As Variety put it, Canton's legacy pictures hit, and hit big. Well, that's Hollywood, a town where Michael Ovitz works as Disney president for 15 months and then leaves with a $140 million severance package, and where the studio head David Beagleman was fired by Columbia Pictures for forgery and embezzlement, and then is hired a few years later as CEO of MGM. But as we'll see in the following chapters, the same sort of misjudgments that plague Hollywood also plague people's perceptions in all realms of life. My own epiphany regarding the hidden effects of randomness came in college, when I took a course in probability and began applying its principles to the sports world. That is easy to do because, as in the film business, most accomplishments in sports are easily quantified and the data is readily available. What I discovered was that just as the lessons of persistence, practice, and teamwork that we learn from sports apply equally to all endeavors of life, so do the lessons of randomness. And so I set out to examine a tale of two baseball sluggers, Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle, a tale that bears a lesson for all of us, even those who wouldn't know a baseball from a ping pong ball. The year was 1961. I was barely of reading age, but I still recall the faces of Maris and his more popular New York Yankees teammate Mantle on the cover of Life magazine. The two baseball players were engaged in an historic race to tie or break Babe Ruth's beloved 1927 record of 60 home runs in 1 year. Those were idealistic times when my teacher would say things like, "We need more heroes like Babe Ruth," or "We never had a crooked president." Because the legend of Babe Ruth was sacred, anyone who might challenge it had better be worthy. Mantle, a courageous perennial slugger who fought on despite bad knees, was the fans' and the press's overwhelming favorite. A good-looking, good-natured fellow, Mantle came across as the kind of all-American boy everyone hoped would set records. Maris, on the other hand, was a gruff private fellow, an underdog who had never hit more than 39 home runs in a year, much less anywhere near 60. He was seen as a nasty sort, someone who didn't give interviews and didn't like kids. They all rooted for Mantle. I liked Maris. As it turned out, Mantle's knees got the best of him, and he made it to only 54 home runs. Maris broke Ruth's record with 61. Over his career, Babe Ruth had hit 50 or more home runs in a season 4 times, and 12 times had hit more than anyone else in the league. Maris never again hit 50 or even 40, and never again led the league. That overall performance fed the resentment. As the years went by, Maris was criticized relentlessly by fans, sports writers, and sometimes other players. Their verdict? He had crumbled under the pressure of being a champion. Said one famous baseball old-timer, "Maris had no right to break Ruth's record." That may have been true, but not for the reason the old-timer thought. Many years later, influenced by that college math course, I would learn to think about Maris's achievement in a new light. To analyze the Ruth-Mantle race, I reread that old Life article and found in it a brief discussion of probability theory and how it could be used to predict the result of the Maris-Mantle race. I decided to make my own mathematical model of home run hitting. Here's how it goes. The result of any particular at-bat, that is, an opportunity for success, depends primarily on the player's ability, of course, but it also depends on the interplay of many other factors. His health, the wind, the sun, or the stadium lights, the quality of the pitches he receives, the game situation, whether he correctly guesses how the pitcher will throw, whether his hand-eye coordination works just perfectly as he takes his swing, whether that brunette he met at the bar kept him up too late, or the chili cheese dog with garlic fries he had for breakfast soured his stomach. If not for all the unpredictable factors, a player would either hit a home run on every at-bat or fail to do so. Instead, for each at-bat, all you can say is that he has a certain probability of hitting a home run and a certain probability of failing to hit one. Over the hundreds of at-bats he has each year, those random factors usually average out and result in some typical home run production that increases as the player becomes more skillful and then eventually decreases owing to the same process that etches wrinkles in his handsome face. But sometimes, the random factors don't average out. How often does that happen? And how large is the aberration? From the player's yearly statistics, you can estimate his probability of hitting a home run at each opportunity, that is, on each trip to the plate. In 1960, the year before his record year, Roger Maris hit one home run for every 14.7 opportunities, about the same as his home run output averaged over his 4 prime years. Let's call this performance Normal Maris. You can model the home run hitting skill of Normal Maris this way. Imagine a coin that comes up heads on average not one time every two tosses, but one time every 14.7. Then flip that coin one time for every trip to the plate and award Maris one home run every time the coin comes up heads. If you want to match, say, Maris's 1961 season, you flip the coin once for every home run opportunity he had that year. By that method, you can generate a whole series of alternative 1961 seasons, in which Maris's skill level matches the home run totals of normal Maris. The results of those mock seasons illustrate the range of accomplishment that normal Maris could have expected in 1961 if his talent had not spiked. That is, given only his normal home run ability plus the effects of pure luck. To have actually performed this experiment, I'd have needed a rather odd coin, a rather strong wrist, and a leave of absence from college. In practice, the mathematics of randomness allowed me to do the analysis employing equations and a computer. In most of my imaginary 1961 seasons, normal Maris's home run output was, not surprisingly, in the range that was normal for Maris. Some mock seasons he hit a few more, some a few less. Only rarely did he hit a lot more or a lot less. How frequently did normal Maris's talent produce Ruthian results? I had expected normal Maris's chances of matching Ruth's record to be roughly equal to Jack Whitaker's when he plopped down an extra dollar as he bought breakfast biscuits at a convenience store a few years back and ended up winning $314 million in his state Powerball lottery. That's what a less talented player's chances would have been. But normal Maris, though not Ruthian, was still far above average at hitting home runs. And so normal Maris's probability of producing a record output by chance was not microscopic. He matched or broke Ruth's record about one time every 32 seasons. That might not sound like good odds, and you probably wouldn't have wanted to bet on either Maris or the year 1961 in particular. But those odds lead to a striking conclusion. To see why, let's now ask a more interesting question. Let's consider all players with the talent of normal Maris and the entire 70-year period from Ruth's record to the start of the steroid era, when, because of players' drug use, home runs became far more common. What are the odds that some player at some time would have matched or broken Ruth's record by chance alone? Is it reasonable to believe that Maris just happened to be the recipient of the lucky aberrant season? History shows that in that period there was about one player every 3 years with both the talent and the opportunities comparable to those of normal Maris in 1961. When you add it all up, that makes the probability that by chance alone one of those players would have matched or broken Ruth's record a little greater than 50%. In other words, over a period of 70 years, a random spike of 60 or more home runs for a player whose production process merits more like 40 home runs is to be expected. A phenomenon something like that occasional loud crackle you hear amid the static in a bad telephone connection. It is also to be expected, of course, that we will deify or vilify, and certainly endlessly analyze, whoever that lucky person turns out to be. We can never know for certain whether Maris was a far better player in 1961 than in any of the other years he played professional baseball, or whether he was merely the beneficiary of good luck. But detailed analyses of baseball and other sports by scientists as eminent as the late Stephen Jay Gould and the Nobel laureate E. M. Purcell show that coin-tossing models like the one I've described match very closely the actual performance of both players and teams, including their hot and cold streaks. When we look at extraordinary accomplishments in sports or elsewhere, we should keep in mind that extraordinary events can happen without extraordinary causes. Random events often look like non-random events, and in interpreting human affairs, we must take care not to confuse the two. Though it has taken many centuries, scientists have learned to look beyond apparent order and recognize the hidden randomness in both nature and everyday life. In this chapter, I presented a few glimpses of those workings. In the following chapters, I shall consider the central ideas of randomness within their historical context and describe their relevance with the aim of offering a new perspective on our everyday surroundings and hence a better understanding of the connection between this fundamental aspect of nature and our own experience. Chapter 2. The Laws of Truths and Half-Truths. Looking to the sky on a clear, moonless night, the human eye can detect thousands of twinkling sources of light. Nestled among those haphazardly scattered stars are patterns. A lion here, a dipper there. The ability to detect patterns can be both a strength and a weakness. Isaac Newton pondered the patterns of falling objects and created a law of universal gravitation. Others have noted a spike in their athletic performance when they are wearing dirty socks and, thenceforth, have refused to wear clean ones. Among all the patterns of nature, how do we distinguish the meaningful ones? Drawing that distinction is an inherently practical enterprise. And so it might not astonish you to learn that, unlike geometry, which arose as a set of axioms, proofs, and theorems created by a culture of ponderous philosophers, the theory of randomness sprang from minds focused on spells and gambling, figures we might sooner imagine with dice or a potion in hand than a book or a scroll. The theory of randomness is fundamentally a codification of common sense. But it is also a field of subtlety, a field in which great experts have been famously wrong and expert gamblers infamously correct. What it takes to understand randomness and overcome our misconceptions is both experience and a lot of careful thinking. And so we begin our tour with some of the basic laws of probability and the challenges involved in uncovering, understanding, and applying them. One of the classic explorations of people's intuition about those laws was an experiment conducted by the pair who did so much to elucidate our misconceptions, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Feel free to take part and learn something about your own probabilistic intuition. Imagine a woman named Linda, 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. In college, she majored in philosophy. While a student, she was deeply concerned with discrimination and social justice and participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Tversky and Kahneman presented this description to a group of 88 subjects and asked them to rank the following statements on a scale of 1 to 8 according to their probability, with 1 representing the most probable and 8 the least. Here are the results in order, from most to least probable. I'll give you each statement and then its rank. Linda is active in the feminist movement, 2.1. Linda is a psychiatric social worker, 3.1. Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga classes, 3.3. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement, 4.1. Linda is a teacher in an elementary school, 5.2. Linda is a member of the League of Women Voters, 5.4. Linda is a bank teller, 6.2. And finally, Linda is an insurance salesperson, 6.4. At first glance, there may appear to be nothing unusual in these results. The description was, in fact, designed to be representative of an active feminist and unrepresentative of a bank teller or an insurance salesman. But now let's focus on just three of the possibilities and their average ranks, listed in order from most to least probable. This is the order in which 85% of the respondents ranked the three possibilities. Linda is active in the feminist movement, 2.1. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement, 4.1. And finally, Linda is a bank teller, 6.2. If nothing about this looks strange, then Kahneman and Tversky have fooled you. For if the chance that Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement were greater than the chance that Linda is a bank teller, there would be a violation of our first law of probability, which is one of the most basic of all. The probability that two events will both occur can never be greater than the probability that each will occur individually. Why not? Simple arithmetic. The chances that event A will occur equal the chances that events A and B will occur, plus the chance that event A will occur and event B will not occur. Kahneman and Tversky were not surprised by the result because they had given their subjects a large number of possibilities, and the connections among the three scenarios could easily have gotten lost in the shuffle. And so they presented the description of Linda to another group, but this time they presented only these possibilities. Linda is active in the feminist movement. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. And finally, Linda is a bank teller. To their surprise, 87% of the subjects in this trial also ranked the probability that Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement higher than the probability that Linda is a bank teller. And so the researchers pushed further. They explicitly asked a group of 36 fairly sophisticated graduate students to consider their answers in light of our first law of probability. Even after the prompting, two of the subjects clung to the illogical response. The interesting thing that Kahneman and Tversky noticed about this stubborn misperception is that people will not make the same mistake if you ask questions that are unrelated to what they know about Linda. For example, suppose Kahneman and Tversky had asked which of these statements seems most probable. Linda owns an international House of Pancakes franchise. Linda had a sex change operation and is now known as Larry. And finally, Linda had a sex change operation, is now known as Larry, and owns an International House of Pancakes franchise. In this case, few people would choose the last option as more likely than either of the other two. Kahneman and Tversky concluded that because the detail Linda is active in the feminist movement rang true based on the initial description of her character, when they added that detail to the bank teller speculation, it increased the scenario's credibility. But a lot could have happened between Linda's hippie days and her fourth decade on the planet. She might have undergone a conversion to a fundamentalist religious cult, married a skinhead and had a swastika tattooed on her left buttock, or become too busy with other aspects of her life to remain politically active. In each of these cases, and many others, she would probably not be active in the feminist movement. So adding that detail lowered the chances that the scenario was accurate enough, though it appeared to raise the chances of its accuracy. If the details we are given fit our mental picture of something, then the more details in the scenario, the more real it seems, and hence the more probable we consider it to be. Even though any act of adding less than certain details to a conjecture makes the conjecture less probable. This inconsistency between the logic of probability and people's assessments of uncertain events interested Kahneman and Tversky, because it can lead to unfair or mistaken assessments in real-life situations. Which is more likely? That a defendant, after discovering the body, left the scene of the crime, or that a defendant, after discovering the body, left the scene of the crime because he feared being accused of the grisly murder? Is it more probable that the president will increase federal aid to education, or that he or she will increase federal aid to education with funding freed by cutting other aid to the states? Is it more likely that your company will increase sales next year, or that it will increase sales next year because the overall economy has had a banner year? In each case, even though the latter is less probable than the former, it may sound more likely. Or, as Kahneman and Tversky put it, a good story is often less probable than a less satisfactory explanation. Kahneman and Tversky found that even highly trained doctors make this error. They presented a group of internists with a serious medical problem, a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot in the lung. If you have that ailment, you might display one or more of a set of symptoms. Some of those symptoms, such as partial paralysis, are uncommon. Others, such as shortness of breath, are probable. Which is more likely? That the victim of an embolism will experience only partial paralysis? Or that the victim will experience both partial paralysis and shortness of breath? Kahneman and Tversky found that 91% of the doctors believed a clot was less likely to cause just a rare symptom than it was to cause a combination of the rare symptom and a common one. In the doctor's defense, patients don't walk into their offices and say things like, "I have a blood clot in my lungs. Guess my symptoms." Years later, one of Kahneman's students and another researcher found that attorneys fall prey to the same biases in their judgments. Whether involved in a criminal case or a civil case, clients typically depend on their lawyers to assess what may occur if their case goes to trial. What are the chances of acquittal, or of a settlement, or a monetary judgment in various amounts? Although attorneys might not phrase their opinions in terms of numerical probabilities, they offer advice based on their personal forecast of the relative likelihood of the possible outcomes. Here, too, the researchers found that lawyers assign higher probabilities to contingencies that are described in greater detail. For example, at the time of the civil lawsuit brought by Paula Jones against then-President Bill Clinton, 200 practicing lawyers were asked to predict the probability that the trial would not run its full course. For some of the subjects, that probability was broken down into specific causes for the trial's early end, such as settlement, withdrawal of the charges, or dismissal by the judge. In comparing the two groups, lawyers who had simply been asked to predict whether the trial would run its full course and lawyers who had been presented with ways in which the trial might reach a premature conclusion, the researchers found that the lawyers who had been presented with causes of a premature conclusion were much more likely than the other lawyers to predict that the trial would reach an early end. The ability to evaluate meaningful connections among different phenomena in our environment may be so important that it is worth seeing a few mirages. If a starving caveman sees an indistinct greenish blur on a distant rock, it is more costly to dismiss it as uninteresting when it is in reality a plump, tasty lizard than it is to race over and pounce on what turns out to be a few stray leaves. And so, that theory goes, we might have evolved to avoid the former mistake at the cost of sometimes making the latter.